Welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 135. Bonjour et bienvenue à Paleo Cinema Podcast 135. This time around, we've got a couple of interesting movies for you. Firstly, from 1953, we have Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn joint called Pat and Mike, which is very, very cool and quite forward-looking in some ways. And then something a bit more gutsy and blokey for us, we have the 1972 Lee Marvin Gene Hackman film Prime Cut, which also stars Sissy Spacek. So it's going to be a good show. I've got some feedback, which is always a groovy and lovely thing, so sit back, relax. I'll get the contact details out of the way, and then we can get on with talking about some movies. Paleo Cinema Podcast appears every 2 weeks and is a podcast of classic film appreciation. The rules are simple and two in number. Firstly, the movie has to be more than 20 years old, and secondly, I have to like it. Feedback is very important, so you can leave reviews on iTunes. You can email me at cultguru@gmail.com, that's cult with a K. Or you can head over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. You can like the page there and add your 2 cents worth. Now, this podcast contains adult language and concepts, so enjoy it. Hi, how is everybody doing? We're fine here. It's still winter, which is a bit odd at the moment because we've had a warm patch where it gets up around 20, 21 degrees centigrade in a very untimely way for about a week now. And that's one of those indications, apart from the fact that, you know, the ice caps are melting and things like that, that global warming is really the flavour of the century. So, I've been watching a few things. I did go to see the new Gojira movie, which was quite good. I think the human stuff, less good than the punch-ups between kaiju. But I think it was done very well. It was done with a full knowledge and recognition of the previous 60-year history of Godzilla. And it did the right thing. It's a lot better than Gino, Godzilla in Name Only, which is the 1998 one. And it's worth checking out. I really enjoyed it. And Sal went with me, and she really enjoyed it too. And when both of us line up like that, it's usually an indication that a movie has some kind of value to it. I have watched a fair bit of cinema since the last time we had a chat. Let's see, I did watch the Peter O'Toole Rogue Mail, the one based on the Jeffrey Household novel, and which is the same source material as an even older movie with Walter Pidgeon in it and George Sanders called Manhunt from the 1940s. So I saw that. I did see another movie, which is I'm kind of mixed about, but is quite interesting. It's called September Affairs from the 1950s and starred Joan Fontaine and Joseph Cotten. Basically, it's about a couple who meet up in an aeroplane ride in Europe, and the plane has to land and is getting repaired, so they go off and visit Naples for a while and miss the plane as they come back to it, and everybody else on the plane dies, so they fall in love and use it as an opportunity to disappear, which is a bit problematic because he's got a marriage and he's about to get divorced, he says, and he's got a son in America, and basically it's kind of star-crossed love. It's a little bit like Brief Encounter in a way, and has the same kind of ending that I don't like about Brief Encounter. But the stars are really nice, and Joseph Cotten is at his most likable in this film in some ways, and Joan Fontaine is much warmer than she is in a lot of other films, so I really didn't mind that one at all. It was a bit of fun. I'd seen it a very long time ago, and I revisited it, and it's worth checking out if you get a chance to. Now, getting back onto my French kick, I watched a Jean Gabin film called Les Désordres de la Nuit, That's Order in the Night, and it stars him as a police detective. It's also got Nadja Tiller as a young girl with whom he becomes involved, and Danielle Darrieux. It's quite a good one. It's very gritty and tough, and black and white, but it's filmed on the streets of Paris, and it's always a little bit of fun, and Gabon always gives his A game to it. Now, I did a movie for the ABC radio gig with Liz Travascus. We did The Wicker Man, so I rewatched The Wicker Man for that, and that was a lot of fun. Really enjoyed that as well. Still can't get past the fact that Edward Woodward's character is such a religious prig. And I can never totally feel sad with the ending of that film. I know it's a character failing of mine, and I should feel worse about it than I actually do. But yeah, the ending of it, even though it is gruesome and horrible and nasty, I can't really totally empathise with Woodward's character, which is an interesting thing there. But, yeah, I saw a couple of recent films as well. I'll just go through the recent films that I saw. I saw Olympus Has Fallen with Gerard Butler in it, and that was pretty okay. I think it's much better than the other one that was like that, whose name is I've totally forgotten, but there were these two movies about the President of the United States being trapped and kind of, yeah, a special forces guy comes in and rescues him from the White House, that kind of thing. But this one's the better of the two. And, yeah, it's definitely worth checking out. Aaron Eckhart plays the president in it. Melissa Leo's in it as well, so it's pretty damn good for that kind of action film, as long as you don't expect too much of it. I did see a black and white René Clair film from the 1920s called The Italian Straw Hat, which is really an interesting little farce, a lot of fun. There aren't a lot of title cards in it because it's all played almost in pantomime and in mime almost. But it's a little bit of a silly story. A guy is about to get married, so he's riding his horse through a park in Paris in his horse carriage. And there's a hat sitting on a tree in the park. And he loses his whip, so he pulls up the horse and goes and gets his whip. And as he comes back, the horse is eating the hat. Now, it turns out that the hat belongs to a married lady who is having an assignation in the bushes with a military officer. And the hat's a one-off. It's an Italian straw hat. It's very hard to find. But she can't go home with a hat that's been chewed up without having a story to explain. So this poor guy who's about to get married has to kind of fend off the wedding party and all of the goings-on with his wedding while he tries to find a matching Italian straw hat for this couple. It's totally silly. And the interesting thing is, even though it's made in the late 20s, about 1928, René Clair films it like it's a movie from the very early 20th century, a black and white film. So it's got static camera work and people move in and out of shots. So he basically went back to the way films were made 15 or 20 years before in order to do it. It's quite fun. And the interesting thing is that people in the wedding party all have one character trait. There's the deaf uncle. There's the bride has a pin stuck down the back of her dress from her dress being pinned up and done. And that's making her uncomfortable. So basically every character has one little twitchy trait, which makes them memorable, and all that plays into the fun and the action. It really is a nice little farce, and I recommend that you check it out, and indeed check out any of René Clair's other films. I did see a classic Jean-Pierre Melville film as well, see another French film, Bob Le Flambeur, Bob the Gambler, which is really kind of cool. I'm not going to say too much about that because I may want to do it for a future podcast. But Bob Le Flambeur is really, really good, and you should check it out. Let's see what else. I'm keeping off the genre films because I talk about them in Martian Drive-In podcast. I did see Mel Brooks' The Producers again with Zero Mostel and Gene Wilder. I was channel surfing, and it was just coming onto the TV channel, so I sat down and enjoyed that. A lot of fun, real lot of fun. Much better than the musical version with Matthew Broderick in it, which is not unfunny, but the Zero Mostel Gene Wilder team works a lot better than Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick, I think. And I saw a kind of late Sinatra film called Assault on a Queen, with Anthony Franciosa, Richard Conte, and Verna Lisi in it. It's a kind of one of those adventure films that could only be filmed in the 1960s, where some guys diving for treasure find a German submarine in good nick at the bottom of the ocean, and they refit it and renovate it and decide they're going to rob an ocean liner using the submarine and its torpedoes as a threat to rob the ocean liner. It's kind of very Rat Packy and very cool and very kind of light. But the interesting thing about it is that it has a soundtrack by Duke Ellington, a really cool jazz soundtrack, which lifts the material just that little bit by having it. Duke Ellington wasn't known for writing soundtracks, of course. He was known for writing jazz music. But in this case, the music does lift the material a lot. And I always like Anthony Franciosa in movies, so I kind of went with that. Sinatra really is cashing a check, really. But the rest of them are pretty cool, and it's a slightly interesting story. Written by Jack, the story was written by Jack Finney, the guy who did the original, who wrote the novel for Invasion of the Body Snatchers and The Seven Faces of Dr. Lowe. So the source material was pretty good, but the movie was kind of just average. So that's about it for what I've been watching lately. I'm going to take a break now, and when I get back, I'm going to talk about Pat and Mike, a lovely little Spencer Tracy, Katharine Hepburn comedy from 1952, which has a couple of features of interest I'm going to talk about.
Aldo Ray, you're the luckiest guy in movies. You know that's true. I am lucky. Let me tell you how it happened. A movie company was working near Crockett, California. My kid brother wanted to get a job as an extra, a football player. So I drove him down to the place just for laughs. But with the way things happen in the movies, I got the job. I was lucky, too. The picture was Saturday's Hero. And then with more luck came The Marrying Kind with Judy Holliday. And now I'm luckier than ever. I'm playing with Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn in a picture called Pat and Mike. How lucky can a guy get? When you work with these two, you're with the best. Miss Hepburn, she's a champ. I mean it. The champion lady golfer. Watch this. And the champion lady tennis player.
What happened when you got there?
Well, the first thing, I disengaged this fellow.
How?
Well, sort of like, I'm sorry.
Let go of me. What am I around here? I'm going to kill someone around here. Am I a sack of potatoes around here or something?
And what were you doing all this time?
Just what I'm doing now.
Nothing?
What else was there to do?
Mr. Tracy, he's a mug, but a nice one. He's the promoter, her manager. Me, well, I'm a ham and egg fighter.
Clongs, I rush him. He's on his bike. Pepper. He starts coming in, and that's when it happened. The thing, the big thing. He's coming, and I look, and who you think it is? It's me coming at me, so I get mad. Rock, rock, boing, boing, boing.
Romance? Sure, lots of it. Romance with laughter.
I can't handle this in my head. It rocks me.
Why?
Well, it's, don't figure it's as though Hucko walked in and handed me an engagement ring.
I'm not Hucko.
That you ain't.
So?
So, there's one thing only about us hooking together. That's what I call a plenty long shot.
Nothing wrong with a long shot.
If you come out on top, that's a fact.
We will, Mike.
If you liked Adam's Rib, you'll love Pat and Mike. It's twice as good.
What?
I see. Is it still going?
Oh. All right, lay down.
Gladly. I'm a back of what?
On your what? If I hurt you, just yell out.
Mm-hmm. Ouch.
I don't think you've ever been properly handled.
That's right. Not even by myself.
Oh, very few brains. Yeah, there's one thing I gotta say, though.
What?
Nicely packed, that kid.
Here's a fact.
Not much meat on it, but what's there is cheers.
All Okay, so Pat and Mike is a 1952 comedy directed by George Cukor and starring Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn. Aldo Ray, as you heard, is in it, though I never liked Aldo Ray as an actor. He was always a bit off. The only thing I really like him in is The Siege of Pinchgut, which is the one filmed around Sydney Harbour in 1959. And it's a great little film. It's very underplayed, which I do like. The comedy in it's underplayed, but it's all in there. The script was written by Ruth Gordon and Garson Kanin, who were married and a very successful writing team together. And I'll just find a nice little plot phrase because it's not a complicated story particularly, but it is quite an interesting one. Pat, played by Katharine Hepburn, is a brilliant athlete, except when her domineering fiancé is around. The lady's golf championship is in her reach, but until she gets flustered by his presence at the final holes. Her fiancé is played by an actor called William Ching. He wants them to get married and for her to forget about the whole thing, but she can't give up on herself that easily. She enlists the help of Mike Conovan, a slightly shady sports promoter played by Spencer Tracy. Together they face mobsters, a jealous boxer played by Aldo Ray, and a growing mutual attraction. So that's basically the plot and the story. And the interesting thing is that you don't see Spencer Tracy for the whole first half an hour or so of the movie. This is all Hepburn's movie right up to that point, which makes it kind of interesting. Hepburn's character, Pat, is playing golf one day with her fiancé, a guy called Collier Weld, who is incredibly annoying. He's patronising, condescending. He doesn't think she can make up her own mind about anything. He's probably the worst fiancé in a lot of movie history that isn't actively nasty to his female fiancé. But they're playing golf to help him get more money for a gymnasium he wants to build at the university. They want to get an endowment. And so they play golf with an interesting couple who he wants to get money from. She blows it for them and tells off the woman. And her fiancé gets the shits with her, basically. So there's a golf pro at the golf course played by Jim Backus, who people remember from Mr. Magoo and Gilligan's Island and Rebel Without a Cause. He was the father in Rebel Without a Cause. Let's not forget his dramatic roles. Who encourages her to go for the women's golfing championship. He thinks she can do it if she just concentrates on what she's doing, puts aside all distractions and just trains for a couple of months. He thinks that she can get to the golfing tournament, which she does. And he is the first of the men in the movie who kind of actually says to her, you can do what you think you can do. Now, she's kind of beaten down a little bit by her fiancé, Collier, and also, you know, she's a widow. So the assumption there, 1952, a widow, her husband died during the war, would be the safe assumption to make on that. So she's kind of rebuilding her life. She's got a fiancé that she doesn't particularly like but doesn't know how to say no to. And Jim Backus' character comes along and encourages her to kind of go for her dreams and go for the things that she really does need to do. And she does. She does very, very well and comes, gets into the last final of the golf tournament. I'm not big on sports, so if the terminology is a bit vague here, I do apologize. So she's up against Babe Didrikson Zacharias, who was a famous golfer and who inspired a biopic as well. There's a movie called Babe in the 1970s where Babe Didrikson was played by Susan Clarke, who people remember was in Night Moves with Gene Hackman, amongst other things. So anyway, she gets right up to the final, but she chokes on the last hole because Collier's there watching and he's got a kind of disapproving look on his face and is really kind of not the most supportive of partners, if you know what I mean. In the meantime, just before that last final, she's met under unusual circumstances a promoter called Mike Conovan, played by Spencer Tracy, who kind of hints at her that she can make a lot of money by coming in second. He can help her by, you know, putting on bets and things like that, and she can end up with a bushel load of money. He asks some very pointed questions about her athletic ability and her training regimen and all that kind of thing, and actually takes an interest in what she does to get to where she is. And it's the first little glimpse there that the two of them are kind of attracted to each other. And that's the nice thing about this film too. It's got a lovely build in the relationship where they're not sure of each other at the start. He thinks she's a prig and is a bit too honest for her own good. She thinks he's basically a Damon Runyon character. And that is how Tracy plays it and how it's written in the original script. He is kind of one of those New York sports interested guys who's got a slightly weird way of talking. He's not educated, but he's smart, and if you know what I mean. And there's a difference there, which a lot of people don't perceive these days. But he really does encourage her, and when she chokes on the last hole of the golf tournament, she goes to him and talks to him about, she actually goes to New York to visit him in his offices up in Times Square. And they kind of decide that he'll be her manager and will train her not only in golf, but she's also very good at tennis as well. And so he trains her in both of those things. And again, Collier turns up and she chokes in the final at the tennis, which is kind of interesting because there's a surrealistic little scene there where Pat sees her tennis racket the size of a saucer. And her opponent has a tennis racket the size of a pizza tray for a family-sized pizza. So she's got the enormous one. And that she flubs on that one too. But, of course, as the things progress, Mike gets involved with some gangsters, one of whom is played by a not-too-tall and very rough-looking character actor called Charles Buczynski, who people later knew as Charles Bronson. And one of the other things that Mike learns about Pat is that Pat's very good at judo. And there's a scene where she takes down not only two other gangsters, but also knocks out Charles Bronson with some very good judo moves and a sap that she takes off one of the other characters. So there you go. This is a movie where Charles Bronson gets the shit kicked out of him twice. Not once, but twice, because they reenacted in the police station as well. Charles Bronson gets his ass kicked twice by Katharine Hepburn, which I think is kind of cool. I really do like that, and I like the way it's done. It's a move that pretty much anybody can do if you watch her very carefully. But, yeah, you can take somebody down from behind very, very easily if you know what you're doing. So that, of course, is part of the joy. Interesting thing is the cop for whom they reenact that scene in the police station is played by Chuck Connors. It's Chuck Connors' first acting role as well. Now, the less said about Aldo Ray in this movie, the better. Aldo Ray was, let's be really honest, never a good actor. He unfortunately had a fondness for the juice, which he had in common with Spencer Tracy as well. And in this, he doesn't really add much to the film. He's got a few scenes as a boxer who are... Mike Condovan is also training, which could have been interesting in the hands of a better actor, but really don't really add much to the film. I did look into the background of the movie, interestingly enough. Yes, I did my homework this time. There was a big collaborative input for this movie between Garson Kane and Ruth Gordon, Spencer Tracy, Katharine Hepburn, and George Cukor. There were a lot of ways they were trying to make this thing work a lot better. They had the raw script, but they wanted to really base it strongly on the chemistry that Hepburn and Tracy had. Obviously, they've been partners for a very long time, even though Tracy's wife never gave him a divorce. It was one of those Catholic things that happened in the 1940s and 1950s. There's been a lot of talk fairly recently about, was Spencer Tracy closeted and gay, and was Katharine Hepburn a lesbian, and was their whole relationship a sham? I don't know whether they were bisexual or not. It's a bit hard to tell. And taking the word on a guy who was basically a gigolo in the 1950s for that isn't necessarily a good source material for discerning the truth. All I know is this. They were incredibly devoted to each other. They were there for each other when both of them needed it. She was Tracy's main carer during his terminal illness around the time of their last film, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. And they did love each other. So that's all I know about it. Whether he was secretly sucking off guys and whether she was dining on Snake Gully, I don't know, and I don't particularly care. I do know a few things about this film, and one of which is It is strongly feminist. A woman decides her own destiny in this movie. She's very talented and very skilled. She has doubts about herself. Yes, she is mentored by men a couple of times. Firstly, by Jim Backus's character, who disappears fairly quickly in the film, which is a shame because he actually did encourage her to take those first steps. And eventually by Mike Conovan. But she makes her own decision. And the interesting twist in this movie, of course, we all know they're going to get together and fall in love and marry and all that kind of stuff. It's that kind of movie, so it's not really a spoiler to say that. But the interesting twist in the film is that they both realize how much in love they are when Mike lets go of control. He's the manager and promoter. He keeps telling her what to do. It's only when he follows her instincts on what she should do and how she should manage things. And he gives up some of the control that things go right for this couple. Now, that's an interesting thing for a movie from the 1950s. And a lot of the Tracy Hepburn films were about that kind of what used to be called female emancipation, about women who don't value their own skills and eventually come into their best selves. And sometimes it's encouraged by a guy, sometimes it's hampered by a guy. But one way or the other, in a number of these films, they really do have that feminist arc to them, which is really interesting. And all credit to not only Hepburn, but Tracy for making that a part of what they did together, which I really like. And it makes these films a lot more accessible than a lot of comedies from the time, which can be seen as much more deeply sexist than this film is. And of course, there are little bits of the moment movie that make you cringe, particularly around Collier, the fiance, and you don't really know why she's with him. And to be honest with you, the interesting and smart thing in this movie is that she doesn't know why she's with him as well. It's just one of those things where she doesn't know how to break it off and doesn't know whether she wants to and doesn't know whether she wants to be alone again. Now, Tracy and Hepburn did 9 movies together, and for the most part, they're really, really good. The ones I'm most interested in are Women of the Year, the first one they did in 1942, a drama they did together in 1943 called Keeper of the Flame, which I found a bit interesting, and is on my list to do for the podcast in future. Then you got State of the Union, 1948, and Adam's Rib in 1949, which is probably one of the most popular of them. You got Pat and Mike in 1952, Desk Set in 1957, and Guess Who's Coming to Dinner in 1967. There are a couple of movies in there, Without Love and Sea of Grass, which I don't know too much about and haven't seen, but the rest of them are great. But I think that at their best, these two were fantastic in comedy together. If there are two people in movies who have great chemistry, these would be your go-to people for it. They're right up there with Bogart and McCall as far as that kind of rapport that comes from real-life intimacy. They are fantastically good together. And the most interesting thing, of course, is, and this is how it works at the best of things, if you have a look at Bogart and McCall and if you have a look at Tracy and Hepburn, the commonality there is the fact that both parties are strong characters. The females in them, Bacall and Hepburn, are as strong as the men in their own way. And that's what makes it work. Not the fact that the woman yields to the man and the woman goes all soft and gooey to the man, but the fact that the partnership is a partnership of equals. And I really like that in these films. Of course, I like it in movies that Bogart and McCall did as well. But I really do like that fact that it means that these movies haven't dated as much. And that maybe seeing Katharine Hepburn playing strong characters in movies inspired women in real life to be stronger as well. And people like Hillary Clinton have said so. So it's really, they are incredibly funny, incredibly good movies. They are full of talented people, even in the peripheries of things, apart from Aldo Ray. And I'd really, the love between Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn shows on the screen. There have been other actors that have been in love you've seen in movies, and you can see the lust on the screen. But you can't really see the love and the high regard for each other as professionals merged in with that love. that you see in this film. It's really, in all of the Tracy and Hepburn films, in fact, it's really part of the magic of these two people together. They, but you know, they did have a troubled relationship, and Spencer Tracy was known to stray out of the relationship, which was itself straying outside of his marriage, if you want to get a bit puritanical about it. But he also had a lot of health issues. The one of the other weird things I found out about this film is the fact that Spencer Tracy took Dexamine to lose weight. It was an appetite suppressant amphetamine to get his weight down a little bit for this film. But Katharine Hepburn, in the test shots they did, was a bit too skinny, so she had to actually gain weight for the film, so she looked slightly curvaceous. Not, well, she's never going to be Mae West, but to just take that leanness off her, she had to actually gain a little weight, which is kind of understandable, because the movie she did immediately before this film was The African Queen, and then you had all of those health problems that the cast and crew of African Queen had filming in the jungles of Africa, which yeah, everybody lost weight during that film. And she then had to go on to play someone who could run around in shorts and hit a tennis ball, which she did very well. And she's a good golfer as well. And there are a couple of golfing scenes in this one where Katharine Hepburn really does show good form and as well in the tennis scenes. It's just really an interesting film from that point of view too, that all of the things you associate with many movies, you know, athleticism, focus on a goal, all that kind of stuff, is in this film Katharine Hepburn's role and not the male role, which makes it, I suppose some people would have seen that as funny at the time, but it kind of works as a kind of serious undertone to the comedy. But anyway, that's about it about Pat and Mike. It really is a lot of fun. I had it on my hard drive for a long time before I watched it, and then I was just in the mood for something a little bit lighter than the things I've been watching. Put it onto the screen and loved it. I think I may have seen it once many, many years ago, but it didn't really stick in my memory. But rewatching it now, it was a lot of fun. And at the time, it wasn't terribly financially successful. It was, in fact, one of their least successful movies. But like a lot of films that I talk about on this podcast, and in fact, like a lot of films in general, if you have a look at some of the best films of all time, Vertigo and things like Citizen Kane, at the time they weren't as highly regarded as they were in subsequent years. And this film's definitely in that category. It plays well to a 21st century audience. So I'm going to take a break now. And when I get back, I'm going to talk about something which isn't anywhere near as feminist as this movie, Michael Ritchie's 1972 crime drama, Prime Cut, starring Lee Marvin and Gene Hackman.
Jimmy, give us some drinks here. How you been, Nick? Been looking all over town for you.
Okay, how about yourself, Jack?
Got some trouble. Big trouble. Kansas City with Marianne. It's getting fat as a water rat. Yours is a lot, Nick. Close to a half a million. He's skimming his own cream and sticking Kansas right up my ass.
Yep.
I need you to straighten them out.
So what's the tab?
$50,000. Anyway, it cuts.
Hello, Jim. Anyway.
Anyway.
Prime Cut is a 1972 American crime movie directed by Michael Ritchie, written by Robert Dillon, starring Lee Marvin, Gene Hackman, Sissy Spacek, Angel Tompkins, and Gregory Walcott. And it's a lot of fun. It's a continuation in a weird way of Point Blank. And Lee Marvin's character is not entirely far away from Walker, the character he played in Point Blank, though Nick Devlin does have a soft spot for some people, and he kind of does have his own agenda in a lot of weird ways. And that makes it interesting. It is a little bit of a variation on the theme there. So, as you can hear from the soundbite I just played, Nick Devlin's hired to go and get $500,000 that the mob is owed by a guy called Marianne in Kansas City, Marianne being played by Gene Hackman. Marianne runs a great big cattle ranch. He's a big guy in town down there. He's out in the country, and he also has a meatpacking plant and runs a sideline in human slavery. So the next scene of real interest in the film, where after Nick and his team go down to Kansas City to get the money back from Marianne, immediately go into town. Nick tells them where to turn. They end up in a really shabby part of Kansas City, go into a really dodgy residential hotel, and Nick immediately beats up on a character called Weenie, who we see in the pre-title sequence of the film, played by Gregory Walcott, who you might remember was the hero in Plan 9 from Outer Space, amongst other things. So Weenie, it turns out, is Marianne's brother, and he's as sick a puppy as Marianne is as well. Right at the start, there's a scene which I won't spoil, and it's odd that I don't spoil the start of a movie, but you've got to see the title sequence that sets up in play the actions that require Nick to go to Kansas City, and they involve Weenie at the meatpacking plant. So Weenie is a nasty character. He's not bright. He's a sick, twisted fuck with cropped hair, doesn't dress very well, and basically he and Marianne are as close as brothers can be. In fact, there's a scene where they beat up on each other the way small boys would. So the characters are well drawn in this film, and the interesting thing is that the characters of Weenie and Marianne are drawn in big, broad strokes, but the character of Nick Devlin, played by Lee Marvin, is drawn very tightly and lightly in small, nuanced bits of work that he does, which makes it much more interesting. So Nick goes and visits Marianne at the meatpacking plant just as there's a big auction of livestock going on. The livestock being auctioned are naked, drugged teenage girls in little pens just like pig pens at an auction. And Nick immediately walks past all of these pens with the girls down to a big long trestle table where Marianne is eating with a bunch of his cronies looking over the soon-to-be auction. And he's eating a plateful of offal. And then there's this nice interchange, which I'm going to play for you just to show how spare the dialogue is in this film, where Nick first confronts Marianne.
Can't be that. That's outstanding.
Nick?
Marianne?
You're a sight for the old eyes.
You too.
How's life been treating you?
Heard you back east.
Chicago.
Chicago?
You know some of the guys, don't you?
Yeah, I know some of the guys. You eat guts.
Yeah. I like them.
Talk now, eat later.
That thump was Nick threatening Marianne with a big butcher's knife. Marianne then gives Nick a parcel and tells him that here's your $500,000, go away. Nick immediately smashes the parcel against the side of a table that's full of beef hearts and guts. So that then starts into play Nick's attempts to get the money from Marianne and Marianne's attempts to kill Nick. Now, on the way out, Nick stops and sees two of the girls who are suddenly lifted up by their handlers, and they're all naked, which is kind of a very confronting thing. One of whom is Sissy Spacek's character, Poppy, and he looks at them and looks at the guy holding them, and she says in a very weak voice, because she's drugged, "Help me." So Nick immediately grabs her, tells the handlers to put her on account and takes her out of that place. And she then becomes under his wing, in a sense, and, of course, is a potential hostage for Marianne in future encounters that they have. Now, Sissy Spacek is very good in this role. It's pre-Carrie, the movie that really defined her. And she eventually tells Nick that she was raised in an orphanage, which is set up specifically as, in a sense, a cattle ranch, and that Marianne is raising children to be sold off to people in a human slavery ring. So Nick, it's a bit hard to tell because Nick's in his 50s and this girl's a teenager. But Nick takes her under his wing. There's no overtly sexual thing between them. but there may well be in the future. Who knows? It's one of those movies where it's a little hard to tell. And Marvin plays it more as a kind of parental role in some ways, though. There is a scene where he arranges for her to get some clothes at the hotel, and they go down to have dinner in the hotel in Kansas City. Now, it's deliberately she's chosen to wear a see-through top, and they go and have dinner in this posh hotel in Kansas City, and everybody else gets shocked by the fact that this young girl is dressed in some very revealing clothing, and one guy stares at her. Now, the reaction that Lee Marvin has to this guy staring at Sissy Spacek in this movie is priceless. It really is a good piece of subtle acting, and it gives us a little insight into Nick Devlin as a character. And there are some other bits as well that show him to be a professional. Yes, he is a kind of enforcer for the mob, but he's a professional, but he's not uncompassionate. One of the guys he's picking up to take down to Kansas City is a little bit embarrassed and says, you know, Nick and the guys pick him up at his house, and his mum and his family are there. And the guy says to Nick, "My mum wants to say hello to you." And he kind of thinks about it and goes, okay. And he goes up and says hello to the guy's mum before they take off for Kansas City. So Nick Devlin's an interesting character because he's got his own code of conduct. He doesn't necessarily buy into mainstream society's idea of what he should be doing, but he knows what's right. He's a professional, but he's an interesting professional. In a way, he reminds me in some ways of a lot of the professional criminals you'll see in 1950s French crime cinema, where they do have their own style, their own kind of gravitas, and their own code of conduct, where the business they're in and the things they do, you can't respect, but you can respect the way they go about doing them. And that's definitely what you get from Lee Marvin in this movie. And the little bits of business there also are really great. Now, there are some really nice set pieces. Howard Hawks once said about movies that a good movie is three good scenes and no bad scenes. Three great scenes and no bad scenes. And that is very much what this movie is. There are at least three great scenes, one of which is him confronting Marianne at that table full of guts. Another one is a terrific little action scene where Poppy, the girl played by Sissy Spacek, and Nick have escaped from the state fair. They've gone to the state fair to confront Marianne. They're chased by gunmen, and they hide out in a wheat field. Big rolling wheat fields out like they have out in Kansas, and they kind of hide among the wheat stalks, and the guys leave, but then an enormous combine harvester bears down on them with a fat redneck motherfucker driving it, and they're being chased through these wheat fields, and it's hard running through fields of crops. I've done it once or twice in my childhood, and they just drag at your legs at the best of times. But Poppy and Nick are running through this field, being chased down by a combine harvester, and Nick's guys in their town car start bearing down from the other direction, and it's a really nice tense scene to see whether they will get saved in time or not. Now, one of the interesting things about that I found a really useful and interesting thing in this film is, even though Nick had just escaped from the state fair with Poppy using his own smarts, and they've hidden out really well, and they've kind of been really good at looking after themselves, when it comes to the crunch with the combine harvester, it's not Nick that takes the action that stops the threat. It's his guys that do it. And I like that, because in a lot of modern action films, the hero's got to be the one who does certain actions when the hero's in peril. It's always focused on that one person, the star. But in this movie, Nick's guys are shown to be professionals themselves and take some very decisive, little bit lateral, but very decisive action to stop the threat of that combine harvester effectively. So that really does play into later in the film, where a couple of the guys get wounded in the big climax of the film. And Nick tells them he'll come back for them. And you know that's true because they came back for him. So you've got that kind of foreshadowing. And the professional respect between the characters, which I kind of like a lot. It's not something that's overplayed, but it's in there and it's really interesting. One of the other complicating factors in this movie and in the plot is Clarabel, who is Marianne's wife, played by Angel Tompkins. Now, Angel Tompkins is an actress who was incredibly attractive, blonde, beautiful, not adverse to getting her kit off in movies, and really a very, very attractive and sexy woman. And she plays Clarabel really as a gold digger kind of character. She's with Marianne because of the things that Marianne gives her, the resources she can keep for herself. And she offers to leave Marianne for Nick in a very obvious way on a little houseboat she has on the Missouri River. And that's a nicely played scene too, where she's putting it all out there and Nick's just not buying it. And it's only really one scene in the movie, but I kind of like it. And I always like Angel Tompkins in a movie, and she's very... I don't think she was a great actress, but she was an actress with a great presence. She later went on to try to get into the management of the Screen Actors Guild a number of times, and she's still around, mostly retired. She's retired from the business, but yeah, in the 1970s, Angel Tompkins was the source of many fantasies for an adolescent me. So I kind of like that as well. And then there's the third great scene in the film is the big action climax, where Nick goes back to Marianne's place and there's an enormous gunfight between him, his guys, and Marianne and Weenie. And the action sequences in this are played pretty well. They're not as paced out and not as kind of storyboarded as they might be in a 21st century movie where everything's done very carefully. But there's a raw chaos to them that I kind of like, and that really does work well in the film. And Lee Marvin, it's interesting seeing Lee Marvin in these action sequences, because as I've said in the podcast before, Lee Marvin was a Marine and became quite badly wounded at the Battle of Saipan. So he has military training. He's got a Smith & Wesson submachine gun, and a very unusual kind of submachine gun in there, and he knows how to move in a combat environment. And you see him do that in this film really well. He looks pretty fit and well in this movie. And he does have that professionalism about the action sequences, which you can't really fake. That kind of instinctive knowledge of what to do and what to not do that only comes from being in a real war with real shooting. And Lee Marvin does that very well. The other thing I really like about Marvin in this film is that beautiful underplaying that he does in a number of scenes. And the kind of... it tells a lot with just a facial expression or just a small gesture. That's another hallmark of really great kind of tough guy actors. They don't overplay things. They don't overstate things. And that's something you'll see as well. I've been watching a lot of French movies lately. And in French action cinema, particularly with actors like Jean Gabin and Jean Sauvé, you'll see that kind of subtlety of movement. And when they get angry and when they take action, it does come unexpectedly. And tough guy actors, you could write books and you could do theses about what makes a good tough guy actor. And I think that kind of economy of emotion, but still giving the audience the things they need to understand about the character, are really a good hallmark of that. There's a lot of... I was just kind of comparing Lee Marvin in this movie playing Nick to Mike Banning, the character Gerard Butler plays in Olympus Has Fallen. And there's not that subtlety of playing in Gerard Butler or in many of those kind of action guys, really. There's one or two who do it. The last person who really did it well was probably somebody like Bruce Willis in his early action movies, not in the later ones, but in the early action ones, kind of portraying that kind of wry self-awareness that Marvin has in this movie. And Gene Hackman's very good too. He's playing it over top. He's got the patented Gene Hackman 1970s comb over where his hair is just not looking good at all. The scenes he does with Gregory Walcott, and Gregory Walcott is very good in this film. He is a nasty piece of shit in this film. He didn't do many movies in the 1970s. The other one I remember him playing in was The Iger Sanction with Clint Eastwood, where he comes off second best to Clint Eastwood a few times. But in this one, Gregory Walcott is kind of a big, dangerous, not bright, but dangerous character. And there's a scene where Poppy's sister, Violet, is abused by Weenie. And we see the aftermath of that. And it's played very subtly and very well in the movie without being at all gratuitous. It's used very much to emphasize the peril to Poppy. And the interesting thing there is that right at the end of the film, Poppy is starting to come into her own as a human being, which are kind of like, there's a little coda at the end of that. But, this movie, Michael Ritchie, the director, this is a very atypical movie in Michael Ritchie's career. He died in 2001, but I'll give you a bit of an idea about the movies that he directed. He did The Fantastics, a movie from 1995 that I like a lot. It's based on a musical. He started out doing things like TV series. He did things like Dr. Kildare, The Big Valley. Did an episode of The Man from U.N.C.L.E. and Felony Squad. Did 11 episodes of a TV series I really want to come out on DVD called Run for Your Life, starring Ben Gazzara. But he did Downhill Racer with Robert Redford. The Candidate again with Robert Redford. Smile, which was all about beauty pageants. Bad News Bears, he directed that. Directed some shit things like The Island and The Golden Child. But he, in between that, he did Fletch with Chevy Chase, which is a little bit of fun. And Cops and Robinsons and The Scout. This movie is tougher than any other film that Michael Ritchie made. It really is a kind of standout movie in his career as far as the toughness of it, the grittiness, the way it harks back to, and I'll say 1950s French crime dramas. It's got that innate toughness to it as well. And it's also got that other thing, which is interesting in a lot of these films, which is that it seems to be in an alternate universe of a particular kind where the police don't get involved. There are no real cops involved in any of this, even though, there are enormously bad things happening on a very large scale in public. The cops aren't around. In this kind of narrative, it's a very straight line narrative. Two guys going head to head. A bunch of good action sequences. A bunch of good character bits. Very charismatic stars. Any involvement with the police in the narrative would have been a distraction and a kind of leaning to one side of it. This is a kind of pure, in that sense, crime action film. And a lot of the best ones, you see that. You don't see cops around much, except maybe as sirens in the distance. It's a kind of criminal alternate universe where the criminals have all the say and run things, which makes it kind of, it does lend a purity to the narrative. And I like that in certain kinds of films. Eventually it gets to the point where it makes them very unreal and unrealistic. But in this one, particularly given the fact that a lot of it is set in wide open spaces where towns are dotted in the landscape of agriculture, you can kind of be forgiven for thinking that the cops aren't around very much in that kind of environment. I remember driving back, for instance, from Sydney just after Easter, and I think I might have seen one cop car in the 900 kilometres we travel from the Blue Mountains down to Melbourne. So, once you get out in the sticks, the law is spread pretty thinly, even here in Australia. But, this film is, it was considered very shocking at the time, particularly for the human slavery aspects of it, and it still is too. It's, it made me angry in a way that, because I know this stuff goes on. I don't know whether it goes on in exactly the kind of agricultural way that Marianne does it in Prime Cut. But you know this stuff goes on, and it is a horrible and nasty thing. And I don't think that this movie shies away from that. It's never seen as kind of prurient or titillating at all. It's shown in a very matter-of-fact way, as if those women were cattle because the people around them are treating them like cattle. I don't think it's kind of sexist in that sense. I think it's quite the opposite, in fact. But that's about all I've got to say about Prime Cut. It really is a good, solid action movie from the 1970s. There are any number of them. In fact, I've got a bunch of them backed up on my hard drive at the moment that I'm going to go through. But this one, Lee Marvin, really does make the movie. I think with anybody else in it, it wouldn't have been anywhere near as good. And that tough guy with compassion really is a role that he plays very well. And as opposed to Walker in Point Blank, where he is self-focused, in a sense, Nick Devlin is outwardly focused. Yes, he's got to get the $500,000 back for the mob, but his focus is on stopping something that he sees as wrong. And I do like that in this movie. So I'm going to take a break now, and when I get back again, I'm going to be doing a little bit of feedback, because yes, we did get some. That, of course, was The Monkees with The Girl That I Knew Somewhere. I thought I'd chuck that in there because I've been playing The Monkees a lot lately and enjoying it as well. So I do have some feedback to pass on to you. I've got a lot of emails. Now, as I said previously, I think, the voicemail number doesn't work anymore. I've been wrestling with K7 voicemails because they offer a free voicemail service. But if nobody uses the number within 30 days, the number lapses. So it's been a real pain to suddenly realize, oh, it's been more than 30 days and the email the phone number has lapsed. So I'm not going with that at the moment. So you can send MP3s via email. I'd be happy to accept them. But the voicemail number isn't working at the moment. Now, last time around, I posed a question of which movie should not be remade, or what is the worst remake? And I got some responses. So the first one's from Roman Scott in Norway. He says, "Hi, Terry. I wager that I speak for many when I say we always appreciate your podcast, even though we can be fearfully, shamefully lazy in not getting feedback to you. Your last podcast featuring The Wages of Fear was a treat from the moment I saw its title. I knew it would be an enjoyable ride, maybe a white-knuckled one, since I finally remember this film burned into me decades ago. You've done it again, another film I have to order. Sometimes we take for granted the films that we saw in our youth. They rest there, a primal substance of ourselves. But we owe these movies another view to dust off the plaques and dormant neurons in our mind. Thank you for also featuring the remake Violent Road. Never heard of this one. I like your expression, jobbing actor, and discussions about these people such as Brian Keith. For some reason, I'm drawn to these character actors. They are like a trace memories, faces I know, but somehow their names are vague, needing to be reacquainted. A French film buff friend of mine recently told me that the French expression for jobbing actor is second knife. Thought you might be interested in that since you're studying the language." Yeah, second knife is a good term for it, really. You asked for worst remake. For me, it has to be The Ladykillers 2004. This leads me to a question for you. Should cinematic masterpieces ever be remade? The original Evening comedies were perfect, hitting comedic notes mirthfully and blackly. The remake is loud and sputtering, way overdone, like a screaming clown trying to grab attention from Buster Keaton. I'm uncomfortable knowing that the Coen brothers were behind the remake, since I usually liked their work. Maybe I'm missing something. Best, Roman Scott." No, Roman, you're not missing anything. The Ladykillers was shit. This is just the way it is. Sometimes people like the Coen brothers overreach themselves, or maybe they got ill-considered projects and they like the original so much they want to kind of do an homage to it. But I don't really think that works at all. I don't think that relocating it out of the original time and place worked at all. But yeah, should cinematic masterpieces ever be remade? My gut instinct says no. I think that they should be able to stand alone. And if they're in a format or in a milieu that we're not familiar with, we should go to them rather than them going to us in the form of a remake. So, yeah, I don't think they should be remade. I don't even like the idea of Friedkin's remake of Wages of Fear on the basis that the original is a standalone and is very, very good at what it does. Yes, it wasn't on genuine South American locations the way Sorcerer was, but there's a kind of roughness and a rawness to the original film that I appreciated, and the remake didn't, even though it did ramp up the tension and all that kind of thing. I don't think it was necessary to remake it. But thanks for that, Roman. I'm glad you're enjoying things. That's what it's about, finding that old stuff that you remember from way back and then going, that's okay, I'm going to reevaluate that. I can warn you, it's a mixed blessing. Sometimes you remake things, you rewatch things that you saw as a kid, and they suffer for it. But it's surprising how much of the stuff that really does sit in your memory solidly is of value, and it's worth looking at once more. So thanks for the feedback, Roman. And Sally wants to know why the Eurovision entry from Norway was a bit odd this year. Okay, so the next bit of feedback I got is from Richard Palmer. He says, "Terry, here's some feedback. Sorry I went on a bit. Maybe you can choose one." No, I'm going to choose them both. I enjoyed the last show, but I didn't have much to say in regard to the trucking movies. I've never heard of either, so I'm glad you brought them to my attention. Now, on to the question you pose, what's a movie remake I dislike? I have two that come to mind immediately. I don't hate the remakes, I just think they miss the boat in a major way. First, La Femme Nikita. I think you actually recently talked about Luc Besson. I'm a fan of his work, but I actually saw the American remake of La Femme Nikita first. I enjoyed the beginning of Point of No Return. The photography and the Nina Simone music really sets a dark and druggy mood. I also like the actor Gabriel Byrne, so I can't put up with the recruitment portion. Harvey Keitel is a welcome character. His cleaner role almost seems a crossover character from another film. Anyway, the movie kept getting softer and softer until the end. I don't remember it that well, but I think they put a happy love story on the end, which is dumb. The other film was The Day the Earth Stood Still, 1951. This is still one of my favourite black and white science fiction films. It was in theatres well before my time, but I like to put it on Saturday mornings once in a while. I think it could stand a good update because it seems very cornball now. However, the remake is even more cornball. The worst part is the inclusion of the kid in both versions, but at least the young boy in the earlier film is used sparingly. The 2008 version expanded the kid role. It really just sucks. The kid is sullen with everybody and just unsympathetic. I think casting Keanu as an alien on a mission isn't a bad idea, but as soon as he starts to show empathy for the kid and the mother, he loses his alienness and therefore his strongest asset, his wooden face. It's also funny that I always thought Patricia Neal was very sexy, so they cast Jennifer Connelly in that role. Makes a lot of sense to me. I think Jennifer, as she matures, is still very hot, but her younger self and Rocketeer, damn, where was I? Oh, of course, they made the lead woman's role modern, which means upgrading the path from secretary to a brilliant scientist slash doctor. She's maybe closer to the alien's intellectual equal in the latter film, but that doesn't help the story. We'd better to make her some crazy environmental activist ready to sacrifice everything herself or son to save the world. That would transfer some of the religious subtext on the earlier film from the alien to the Earth woman. It would also avoid her forcing involvement in every part of the picture, which just seems unlikely. I think Michael Rennie and Patricia Neal spent a few minutes in an elevator together, and that's what they needed. Richard Palmer. Richard, let's see. First off, La Femme Nikita is great. The original is a kick-ass, hardcore action flick, and Luc Besson did a good job on it. But yeah, the remake with Bridget Fonda, not so much. That's probably a pretty good rule of thumb, and there probably are exceptions, and I'm willing to listen to the possibility. American remakes of French films are always worse. I don't care what the film is. If it's an American remake of a French film, there's something lacking. I don't know why. You can have good scriptwriters, you can have good actors, you can have good directors, you can have good best boys. But taken out of the context, it really doesn't work with French movies. Don't know why, but that's just a rule. Now, Day of the Earth Stood Still, the one with Keanu, bit nihilistic, really, isn't it? With the whole taking away all the technology bit at the end. And Keanu, I think, very limited actor. I think in certain roles he's good, but they should have got somebody genuinely spooky. But they went with the star thing and go, okay, who's a spooky star? Keanu Reeves will get him. And I don't think that works. I could see someone like Cumberbatch doing an okay job on him and having that kind of haughty distance about him. But they really didn't think it through, and it was all about the special effects. And when a movie becomes all about the special effects, it definitely loses things. But they're both good choices, and I can respect your opinions on those ones, Richard. Now, I've got to think up a question to throw at people for this time around. Okay, name an actor and an actress from classic films who, doesn't matter how good they are in them, you don't like. You really detest them. For me, there's usually a few of them around, and I'll talk about them more next time when we're doing the feedback. But who are the actor and actress you really can't stand in classic films? Not modern ones, because you can pick 15 or 20 out of modern films. But in classic films, who are the actors and actresses you really don't like at all? So that's about it for the feedback, and indeed it for the podcast this time around. It's just started raining outside, which I like because it hasn't rained for a while. Anyway, I'll be back in 2 weeks with another podcast and two more films. I'll be back in a week with the Martian Drive-In podcast. They'll be there, it'll be square. And in the meantime, look after yourselves. Enjoy your movie watching. Chat with me on Facebook if you like. I'm there most of the time. And I'll be back in 2 weeks' time. Bye-bye.